Blog Talk Radio.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
He's probably taken the last count.
For African people, nothing important happens without a light issue. So for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind. Flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continue to improve, continue to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diaspora, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that describes them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our children and those yet to be born. for they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, but they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation. Ashe, ashe, asheo.
Listening to Warriors Way Radio, where their motto is continue the battle. Your host is Brother Kwasi Kwarah. Warriors Way Radio is an affiliate of the Sankofa Historical Society, which is a part of the Black Reality Think Tank. And they are operating on the Block Talk Radio Network. Check them out. Email them at warriorsway101@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com. Go to the search portal, put in the Sankofa Historical Society, and check out any of our programs that are there. They air every Thursday evening. 6 o'clock. Warriors Way Radio. Continuing the fight.
The 1936 Summer Olympic Games in Berlin was a major milestone in the Olympic pantheon. These were the first Olympic Games televised worldwide, and the German host created a grand spectacle that would set the standard for modern Olympics to this day. But there was also much controversy surrounding this 1936 Olympiad. Adolf Hitler was in command of Nazi Germany, and the anti-Jewish propaganda weighed heavy on the athletes. Countries wrestled with the decision of whether or not to participate in the Berlin Games or boycott them altogether. Hitler firmly believed German athletes would dominate the events and proved that the Aryan race was the master race. Jesse Owens, a young track and field phenom from Ohio, believed otherwise. Jesse's world record achievements in 1935 bought him an invitation to the Berlin Games, and Jesse accepted. On August 3, 1936, Jesse won the 100-meter sprint, defeating fellow African-American Ralph Metcalf in a world record time of 9.4 seconds. The very next day, Owens nearly didn't qualify for the long jump. He fouled on his first two jumps. German competitor Karl Lutz Long, a model Aryan Nazi and Owens' stiffest competition, offered some friendly advice as to where to mark a takeoff point. This adjustment helped Owens qualify for the event and eventually garnered Jesse his second gold medal of the week with an Olympic record jump of 26.67 feet. Long was the first to congratulate the new record holder and took a victory lap around the track with Owens arm in arm. Owens said at this moment, "You can melt down all the medals and cups I have, and they wouldn't be a plating on the 24-karat friendship I felt for Lutz Long at that moment. Hitler must have gone crazy watching us embrace. The sad part of the story is, I never saw Long again. He was killed in World War II. The German public adored Jesse Owens. His status grew as one of the main attractions at the Summer Games of 36, and Jesse provided the fans with even more to celebrate. On August 5th, Jesse claimed another gold in the 200-meter sprint with a world record time of 20.7 seconds. And finally, Jesse joined the American 4x100 meter relay team, and together they took the gold medal on August 9th.
Jesse Owens has just paved the way. I just feel a huge amount of gratitude, you know, for him, because it was during such a difficult time that he won all these events, had so much success. And it was, you know, such a hard time with so many difficult things going on in the world.
I don't know how he did it. And I think that's really cool. I mean, that's inspiring.
I get goosebumps from just that story of Jesse Owens and the sportsmanship that comes out of that, the friendship that comes out of that.
Being respectful regardless of the time.
And so to me, he's inspiring. You know, if he can get through that and made so many sacrifices for us to be able to compete, you know, now, it's just a huge thing and a great reminder.
Friendships born on the field of athletic strife are the real gold of competition. Awards become corroded. Friends gather no dust.
Welcome to Warriors Way Radio. This is your host, Kwazi Kraft, Shuja Kwatu Kraft, your warrior for the people. We have a wonderful show tonight. Before we take this further, I'm going to have my daughter continue with an answer to a profile. We're going to be talking about Jesse Owens. And my daughter, Kimberly, go ahead.
Who was Jesse Owens? Jesse Owens, also known as the Buckeye Bullet, was an American track and field athlete who won 4 gold medals and broke 2 world records at the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin. Owens' athletic career began in high school when he won 3 track and field events in the 1933 National Interscholastic Championship 2 years later. While competing for Ohio State University, he equaled 1 world record and broke 3 others before qualifying and competing in the 1936 Olympics. Owens was born in James Cleveland Owens in September 12, 1913 in Oakville, Alabama. The son of a sharecropper and the grandson of enslaved people, Owens was a frail child who was often sick and battled with chronic bronchial congestion and pneumonia. He was still expected to work at a young age of 7, picking up to 100 pounds of cotton a day to help his family put food on the table. At the age of 9, Owens moved in with his family to Cleveland, Ohio, where the young JC discovered a world far different from the slower Southern life that he has already known. School proved to be one of the bigger changes that's gone through one schoolroom household he attended in Alabama, replaced by a bigger setting with stricter teachers. Here, Owens earned the nickname that would stick with him for the rest of his life. One of his instructors, unable to decipher his thick Southern accent, believed the young athlete that his name was Jesse, when he in fact said his name was J.T. At East Technical High School, Owens quickly made a name for himself as a nationally recognized sprinter, setting world records on the 100 and 200-yard dashes as well as the long jump. After graduating, Owens enrolled at Ohio State University, where he continued to flourish as an athlete. At the 1935 Big Ten Championship, the Buckeye Bullet, as he was also known, overcame several severe tailbone injuries and tied a world record in the 100-yard dash and set a long jump record of 26.8 that would stand for 25 years. Owens also set new world marks in the 220-yard dash and 220-yard low hurdle. His dominance at the Big Ten Games was par for the course of Owens that year, which saw him win 4 events at the NCAA Championship, 2 events in the AAU Championship, and 3 others at the Olympic Trials. In all, Owens competed in 42 events that year, winning them all. For Adolf Hitler and the Nazis in the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games were expected to be a German showcase and statement for the Aryan supremacy. Hitler lambasted America for including black athletes on its Olympic roster, but it was the African-American participants who helped cement America's success in the Olympic Games. In all, the United States won 11 gold medals, 6 of them being by black athletes. Owens was easily the most dominant athlete to compete. He captured 4 gold medals, the 100 meter, the long jump, the 200 meter, and the 400 meter relay, and broke 2 Olympic records along the way. Owens' world record for the broad jump would last 25 years until being broken by an Olympian, Irvin Robinson, in 1960. After Owens won the 100-meter event, a furious Hitler stormed out of the stadium, though some reports indicate that Hitler later congratulated the athlete on his success. While Owens helped the United States triumph at the Games, his return home was not met with crying or fanfare, one might expect. President Franklin D. Roosevelt failed to meet with Owens and congratulate him, as was typical for champions. The athlete wouldn't be properly recognized until 1976, when the President Gerald Ford awarded him a Presidential Medal of Freedom. The mild-mannered Owens seemed not the least bit surprised by his home country's hypocrisy. He said, and I quote, "When I came back to my native country after all the stories about Hitler, I couldn't ride in the front of the bus." He said, "I had to go to the back door. I couldn't live where I wanted. I wasn't invited to shake hands with Hitler, but I wasn't invited to the White House to shake hands with the president either." In the later years, following the 1936 Olympic Games, Owens retired from amateur athletics and started to earn money for his physical talent. He raced against cars and horses, and for a time, played with the Harlem Globetrotters. Owens eventually found his calling in a public relations and marketing setting of businesses for himself in Chicago, Illinois, and traveling frequently around the country to speak at conventions and other business gatherings. Owens died of lung cancer in Tucson, Arizona on March 31, 1980. He smoked up to a pack of cigarettes a day for a good deal of his life. Owens was married for nearly 48 years to Ruth Owens, longtime chairwoman of the Jesse Owens Foundation, an organization dedicated to supporting the development of young people.
All right. Well, thank you, Kimmy. Thank you for that ancestral profile. We're going to have to do that again. And we're going to, you know, this, before we get into this, we're going to be talking with our Olympic champion, having a conversation with Johnny Davis. I'm just going to give you a little bit of info on him. But before I do that, I'm going to have my son, because one of the things that we, you know, like we all, it's a family thing what we do here. And my son, when he, this is my second marriage. My first wife passed back in 2008. She struggled with breast cancer, and she had that for several years. I believe it started when she was in high school, and she had on 8 different occasions, you know, it came back, you know. So she passed from those injuries, so she's one of our ancestors now. But my son, during that time, you know, he didn't have his best years, you know, back then. Right in high school and stuff like that, you know, after my wife, his mother had passed and so forth. So he didn't have a good freshman year, but he picked everything up. But he was not a school athlete, did well in school and everything, and he was playing football, and his coaches wanted him to go to state college. But he said, "No, I want to play at the Division I level, and I'll do anything to get there." And they were like, "Well, your grades don't cut it. You don't do well enough, and I'm telling you, it's not going to work for you. You need to go to the state house." And he didn't want to do that. And even myself, I'm like, okay, maybe, man, you should look at this. You know, they're telling you that this and that. We even went to a couple of schools, and they were really hyping it up. They wanted him to be there because he was the number one running back in the state of Wisconsin, led in rushing yards and touchdowns. And so he was recruited, but, you know, they were trying to say academically he wasn't sound. He didn't go with that. And I was like, fine, whatever you think you need to do. So he went to a junior college, helped them win 2 national championships, and he went from running back to linebacker, and he maintained the 3.89 GPA. He had the second highest grade point on the team. And so, and then later on, he had initially going to go to Purdue. Then injury where Purdue just kind of skipped out of it, and that was a kind of a devastating thing, but he still kept his focus and then went on to Toledo, another Division I school. And so at this point, he's went to Toledo, played ball, and then during this pandemic, things changed quite a bit. He ended up transferring. Long and short of it, he did graduate from Toledo, from a Division I university. did very well there, and now he's in grad school and getting ready for the combine for the NFL. So I'll let him explain some things to you.
Yeah, so like you said, I started out my journey, you know, at St. Francis High School, ventured off to a junior college. I wanted to bet on myself. I saw a lot of the, you know, players that were able to make it to the NFL from the junior college that I attended, College of DuPage. So that really motivated me and really encouraged me to want to go there in the first place. It was a struggle at first. I came in as a running back. You know, I was the top running back in Wisconsin, basically. And then when you go to college, things are, you know, a lot different. I came into a room full of, like, 15 running backs, and, you know, they have their sight on who they want to play, and you just really got to, you know, prove yourself at one point. But they got to a point where they wanted me to switch positions, and my whole thing was I'm not going to waste my time there. I'm going to make the most out of it. If they believe that I can be a great player at this position, I should give it a shot. So I switched to playing linebacker, which took some time to adjust, and I was probably like a third string for the first couple games, and eventually, once I got the hang of everything, I evolved into the role of a starter, and you know, I didn't look back. And then my second year, I had an injury, had a torn MCL after I got offered by Purdue. That was my first. That was my first Division I scholarship. I got that after I attended a camp. That's one thing a lot of, you know, guys in junior college didn't do. Just because there's always a lot of high school kids there, you know, they felt looked down upon just because, you know, they were older than a lot of those guys. But, you know, I didn't really care. I wanted to put myself in the best possible situation. So that's why I attended that camp. And after a couple hours of that, you know, I was just my first scholarship. You know, that was just a big thing to me just because a lot of people in high school just never thought I could make it to that point. Then, you know, I went to the University of Toledo, where I am an alma mater there. I got my business administration degree as my bachelor's. And I played 2 years there. Didn't play as much as I wanted to, but, you know, I got a lot of experience. I played with a lot of guys who are currently stars in the NFL. And, you know, you're in a you have a really big platform, especially when you're playing Division One. The amount of people that look up to you, and a lot of people that you're able to meet and network with over the years that are going to become, you know, long-term only friends, but, you know, associates later on in life when it comes to the business realm of things as well. So that was a huge thing, you know, I had to learn. And, you know, it was just a great experience. And then once the pandemic hit, you know, things got really tough, and I had a choice to make if I wanted to, you know, play there one more year and just kind of be a role player, or if I wanted to, you know, be a starter and, you know, really pursue a shot at the NFL. So that's why I decided to transfer and, you know, go to New Mexico and New Mexico Highlands, which is a Division II school. And I did that. I played this most recent season there. And, you know, it was a great experience. And I was able to start my master's. So a lot of people, you know, didn't really think I could make it to where I was. But, you know, the moral of the story is you really just got to keep pushing, especially if you want to go to the places you want to go to. And don't settle for any less. Just really push yourself to your limits, and that's what I really harped on.
All right. Well, thank you, man. Thank you. I'm going to talk about our guest a little bit before I introduce him, Johnny Davis. He learned a little bit about Johnny Davis. He learned to roller skate at age two. And a year later, he was skating so fast that he had to be slowed by the rink skate guard. He switched to ice skating at the age of six, and a few months before his mother enrolled him in a local ski skating club. Soon afterwards, Davis began to win regional competitions, and at age 17, he moved to Marquette, Michigan to improve his training opportunities. Although Davis was called for a team skater, his talent quickly overcame this apparent disadvantage, and he qualified for both the U.S. short track and long track teams for the 1999 Junior and World Championship. In 2005, Davis became the fourth American and the first African-American athlete to win the World All-Around Speed Skating Championship. And on February 18, 2006, He also skated a 26.60 second final lap to win the men's 1,000-meter long track final at the Winter Olympic Games in Turin, Italy. Now, 3 days later, he captured the silver in the 1,500-meter. Now, David's success continued at the 2006 World Skating Championship, where he won a second all-around title, posting world record overall, scoring 145 out of 742 points. He also broke the world record for the 1,500 meters, adding that to the 1,000-meter record he had set November 5th. And in 2009, Davis won the World Speed Skating Championship, becoming the second man only after Eric Heiden to win both all-around sprint and world championship over the course of his career. At this time, I am going to open up the line. And Shani, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for having me today, of course.
Oh, man. thanks. I have a host of questions for you. I was hoping that my brother could be here. I mean, I kind of jumped to some other situations when you were 17 and some of the other things that you did prior to some of your Olympic runs and stuff like that. I didn't realize that you were roller skating. I mean, ice skating, roller skating first, and then you went to the ice skating.
Yeah, that's correct.
At such a young age, I mean, did you figure out that you wanted to speed skate? I mean, who's your role model?
I didn't have any role models sports-wise in the skating world. This was something that, like, I was interested in because people kind of pointed me in that direction, and I fell in love with it when I first touched the ice when I was 6 years old.
And so when you did that, you got to the speed skating, and I know you have a relationship with my brother. When you and your mother, you came up here at the age of 8?
Yeah, we used to come up from Chicago, and then since there's not a lot of black people skating, Olu noticed me and my mother and I, and he always gave us he offered us a place to stay since he knew that we were coming from Chicago. Really kind of him to do.
Right. Well, that's awesome. I mean, you know, this family business kind of thing, how we look after each other, I mean, I think that's some information that needs to be put out there because we always hear a lot of these different stories about people being adopted and being taken in and then, you know, giving some guidance and instructions and stuff like that. I did talk to my brother. He couldn't be here, but I know he coached you quite a bit. And, you know, one of the things that he was saying about you was that you were very talented and you didn't need much coaching in the sense that once he did tell you something, I mean, you got it, and you got it very quick. And I don't know, did you find that to be, you know, kind of tough for you? I mean, just looking around, I mean, we always look for role models and stuff like that, and when you, like I said, you're that kind of standard. I mean, who are you looking up to as far as the skating? You know, who are your champions at that time?
So,
did it make a difference?
You know, so America always looked up to Bonnie Blair and Dan Hansen and Eric Heiden, of course, but I couldn't really identify with them because, you know, we're from different backgrounds and stuff, so my heroes in skating came from the club that I began with. They looked like me. There was a ton of black athletes, speed skating. We had a black head coach in Evanston. And I looked up to them more than anything because they made me feel welcome and accepted in the sport of skating.
Yeah. So was it different when you trained with the people up here versus when you got away from, you know, back home when you were skating?
It was just a total culture shock when we would go up to Wisconsin and be in the West Allis. And, you know, we are an all-black club, and then we go up to West Allis, and it's like the exact opposite. And the thing that made me feel so welcome and at home there was, of course, meeting your brother. He just came over, and he was like that, like, strong, like, male adult that I needed that in my life to kind of just give me more inspiration. Like, when I met Olu, he reminded me of a superhero. You know, he's so big and strong. He's like a weightlifting champion. And he liked his, you know, music and stuff. And he just reminded me of a superhero, you know, like a Clark Kent by day, but then like Superman at night, like, or like when he went in the phone booth and powered up. So I always admired that about Olu as a young, at a young age.
Now, how was it like for you when you were competing? I mean, when you got on the track, I mean, you were that, usually that only black person out there, or was there anybody else that looked like you out there on the track when you got here in Wisconsin?
The higher I got up in ranking, the less black athletes there were. It was just like I felt alone, and I felt most of my friends that I started off the sport with, they just kind of got discouraged, or they got kind of unmotivated to want to skate, so they started doing other things where they felt more welcome. But thanks to Olu, like, that made me feel like I had family, so I never had that sense of, like, not belonging.
Sure, sure. I tell you, I know that that's very important. I mean, because when you feel you don't belong, then you start looking into other things, and your focus isn't as good, but, I mean, it's just outstanding that you kept that focus so that you could do the things that you're doing. And did you, I mean, talented as you are, but, you know, they talked about, you know, your height, like that's a disadvantage. And I don't understand the sport enough to know that that's a disadvantage, but, I mean, you did so well. How were you received after you started winning?
You know, back then when I was winning, my body type for skating wasn't like, no one really seen that. I was kind of like the first guy, like a hybrid athlete that can do sprint, middle distances, and distance. And now if you look at it, you see a lot of people that are like my height. They're taller, they have longer legs. It's not like the stereotype that you have to be big and bulky and powerful to skate. You can do it more with technical skating and finesse. So I like that I was a kind of like a trendsetter.
You know, I'm wondering, you know, like a lot of times when athletes, you know, like Florence Griffin Joyner, when she was in the Olympics, and she did so well so soon, and people didn't want to believe her talent level, so they felt that she was cheating some kind of way, and so they had her test. Did you go through those type of scenarios and situations where they just didn't, they felt you were doing something maybe illegal?
Yeah, a lot of people had rumors about me that I was cheating or doping and things like that, but I wanted to take, like, stuff to get stronger when I was younger, but when we called in the drug hotline, it's not a hotline, and they said to take at our own risk, like, it could be, like, a legal substance or not, you know, you're on your own, you can take it if you want to. That was the first and the last day I ever went to take supplements. I just said, like, I'll get strong based on hard work, and I'm not going to make medicine or any type of pills help me get stronger. I didn't want to take that risk.
I tell you, do you feel that there's a difference when you look at that? Because when you look at that, Ikan Shikari, is it Richardson? And then there was a Russian skater that was suspended for using sports-enhancing drugs. And then they allowed her to compete. Now, she didn't do well. But, you know, is there an extreme difference, you think? I mean, is that something, it just seems like you can't get around something like that. Do you think that's a fair situation? Because they even had, you know, a former Olympic athlete make a comment about Shikari Richardson talking about she smoked that marijuana and, you know, that was a violation. But, again, it's not a sports-enhancing drug. She was depressed. I mean, it wasn't going to do anything to help her win and stuff, but she was out of that Olympics. She may have done extremely well, you know, at that point in her life. But, I mean, what are your thoughts on something like that?
You know, unfortunately, we'll never know, like, what could have happened if things would have went, you know, a certain way or a certain outcome. It's just that if they don't like you in terms of, like, the governing body, the media portrays you in a certain way or image, no matter what you do, they're going to find a way to kind of bring you down. So you really have to be very cautious when you're like on the top of the world and people are looking for reasons to bring you down. And unfortunately with her, you know, she is depressed and it wasn't a sports-enhancing drug. It's just they didn't like it, so they just chose to use it against her. It's really sad, actually, if you think about it.
Yeah, I know. I don't know where she is now mentally, and I mean, it's just such a devastating thing that can happen to a person because, you know, with the Olympics and, everything is just so regimented as far as what you need to do, your rest, sleep, this and that, your training. Everything is, you know, boom, 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 boom. And, you know, little time for, you know, error here and there. And so it's a tough life. And so living that life, I mean, how financially, I mean, was that an expensive thing? Did you get sponsors? Where was your help? I mean, I know you said my brother did some things, but, you know, the skating aspect, that's expensive. I mean, is that a reason why maybe a lot of other blacks don't get involved? Because skates are very expensive.
I think it's just kind of like the geography of, like, where these rinks are located. You know, I'm from Chicago, and the closest rink that I would have to go to, like, in speed skating, it would be, like, in Evanston, which was, at the time, maybe 45 minutes to an hour away. I lived on the south side of Chicago. They don't have a lot of structured clubs and, like, things at the park district that are easily accessible for kids like us to do. So a lot of the time, you know, I consider speed skating more of an elitist sport, and it's like a country club, and you got to kind of have an invitation. So I would have never found out about the sport if my mother didn't work for someone that had a son in speed skating. You know, like, that's the only way that we got into it. So I got lucky, but it's hard to find it on your own.
Was there something else that you think you might have been interested in other than speed skating? I mean, did she have to force you into looking at the skating aspect of things, or was that okay with you?
I loved speed skating since the first day I stepped on the ice. I was just compelled watching my teammates around me skating fast, and then it was a challenge because before that I did roller skating, and I did, like, roller blading, and I was fast on the roller blades, and then I got to the ice. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm gonna master this. I'm going to conquer this. And then I took two steps, and I fell on my face, and I didn't have the ankle strength. I didn't have the balance to, you know, balance myself on a thin blade and, like, you know, the ice and all that other different types of, like, surfaces and stuff. It was really tough. So a lot of times, you know, people can grow impatient because they don't see themselves improving. But I was just captivated. I loved the coach. I loved the club. I loved the athletes that I was with. And I think because of them, it allowed me to stay with the sport. If it wasn't for them, I probably would have gave it up much sooner.
Well, you know, I know the training is just off the charts. I mean, you have your on-season training and your off-season training. Your diet is so good. You know, I mean, you don't put any contaminants in your body. At least you try not to because, you know, some of those things can be looked upon as, you know, targeted as some kind of substance that's, you know, that could be banned or whatever it may happen. I mean, I've heard of some cases where some people did not take any performance-enhancing drugs. They took some type of cold medicine or something, but it gave a bad reading and so forth. And you know, you have to be real diligent in what you take and what you don't take, I mean, as you mentioned earlier. But, you know, as far as, you know, your strength training and all of that, I know my brother helped you out a lot with that, but just looking at some of these other people, you know, like you said, you didn't relate to Dan Jensen, but I'm sure you heard the conversations when they talked about how many times they can squat weights, 225, so many times, and all of that. Were you intimidated by people being so strong? Because you were a taller, thinner speed skater, but you were very powerful, very fast, and I mean, once you got on the track, that just changed everything and how people looked at you. So, was you know, what got you going like that? I mean, you know, what was the strength training a big plus for you, you know, it didn't matter to you? I mean, you just wanted to have something to prove or chip on your shoulder. What was it?
I think just seeing what other people were doing around me compelled me to want to try it myself, and then I got into it, and I saw, like, that was a tool that I would need to use to be able to get me to the next level, and I struggled with that at first because I didn't start weight training until I was, like, 16, 17 years old, and a lot of the other kids that I was competing against started weight training at a much younger age, and they had an advantage over me, but I didn't focus on the things I didn't have. I focused on what I had control of, and that was like my physical fitness. I was a cardio machine.
Right.
I could run for hours and, you know, lots of endurance. And eventually I started to add in those other tools like weight training and things like that, and it just made me a better athlete, all-around athlete.
You feel that gave you some longevity in the sport? I mean, how many Olympics did you compete in?
I competed in 5, and definitely not having those heavy weights on my back allowed me to, you know, have a longevity, longer life in skating, because a lot of people, as you're aware of, they have really bad backs because of weight training and bad knees. I had bad knees, but I definitely didn't have a bad back, and that's almost like a career ender, because once the back goes bad, you injure it, you put all those, you know, hundreds of pounds on your back. I've seen people back squatting, you know, over 400 pounds and stuff. I mean, this hurts your back, and you have to be in that unorthodox position, skating position, where you bend down at 90 degrees and you have your back hunched over, speed position.
Right.
I'm lucky that I didn't get into weights early. I'm kind of thankful I didn't.
Wow. I mean, you know, I think about that as well, because I missed the weightlifting start. I mean, my brother was, you know, I mean, he went to school for it and everything and did some, got all those records doing the powerlifting. I was just doing it when I was playing football and then when I started fighting, but I was just, I never went beyond 600 pounds as far as squats. But everything I did comfortable and stuff. But I've always seen people do some different techniques that scared me. And I was like, I wasn't going to try and go much heavier than that because I just didn't like the way actually, I'll put it this way. I've never had any major injuries in regards to weightlifting. Most of my friends that have got into certain things, weightlifting and just trying to max out and go as heavy as they could all the time, a lot of those guys have had surgeries in regards to that. I haven't had that, so very fortunate in that regard. Have you reached out to, I mean, what are you doing now? You're coaching? Did you get offers from the U.S.? And prior to that, do you have a lot of sponsors here? When you were skating for the U.S., I mean, how did that look?
It was kind of like, didn't get as much Olympic, I mean, American sponsors as the next Olympian with my accomplishments. Not too many people have them. But thankfully enough, I was really popular in Europe. I was really popular in Holland, and that's like the number one country for speed skating. And they kind of looked out for me, and I was able to kind of make a career out of it. And thanks to them, I was able to afford a lot of like the trainings and stuff, because I had to live away from home. I had to pay my own travel expenses and training expenses. I had to pay for my coaches and things like that. And thankfully enough, I got popular at the right time and things kind of fell into place. And more or less nowadays, I'm comfortable, but I'm working on writing. I'm trying to write my book, My Story is Untold. I don't feel like the media's ever did a really good fair share of portraying me. So I want to get my side of the story out. And I'm doing coaching with some people that are passionate and wanting to learn about skating. My door's open to anybody, any skill set or age. I don't turn people away that are wanting to learn skating.
Well, you know, what that makes me think about when you talk about telling your story, and I'm thinking about, so you competed in 5 Olympics, and in the last Olympics, was it they were trying to decide, during Black History Month, who should they have carry the, was it the torch? A light the torch?
It was the flag.
The start
was bear the flag.
Or the flag?
Yeah.
Or carry the flag
ceremony.
For the,
yeah.
Okay, for the opening ceremony. And so I just thought, you know, Black History Month, you know, you got your first black speed skating champion and, you know, recognized all over the world for all these accomplishments. And you were still basically the only black person out here at that time. And so I thought that that was just a shoo-in. And, but, you know, do you want to comment on that or your thoughts?
Well, I also thought it would have been like a no-brainer to kind of put me in, because the person that they chose, my accomplishments were far more, far greater. But, you know, it came between a coin toss. It's unfortunate that they just kind of disregarded all the things that I've done.
Right.
Really take that into, you know, consideration when choosing the flag bearer. But because of what I went through 4 years ago, now there's like multiple flag bearers. They have, you know, three or four flag bearers out there now.
So, right, right.
They didn't really care too much about the extent of what that did to like my final Olympics, like kind of casting like a dark cloud over my,
right,
you know, my
right.
fifth Olympian. But my whole Olympic career has been plagued with controversy and negative stuff, and that was just one that just, you know, put the cherry on top, I guess. But, you know, at the end of the day, at least something came about it that changed, so it helped people further, like, down the road, and they don't have to, hopefully they won't have to go through what I went through in terms of that. You should only have to focus on, you know, performing your best. You shouldn't worry about all the other stuff that, you know, that they kind of put me through there, those last Olympics.
Wow. I tell you, that really threw me for them to pick this female. I mean, I know that she had been in her, I think it was her fifth Olympics as well. But again, not as many accomplishments. But again, you know, when I think about everything, and I don't know if you heard, but prior to the show, we did an ancestral profile. We did it on Jesse Owens. And Kimmy read that, and when I was reading about Jesse Owens, you know, and everything that he went through, you know, where Hitler eventually acknowledged him, you know, after winning his medals and so forth. But when he came back to the United States, you know, he did not receive the welcome that he thought he was receiving. President Roosevelt did not invite him to the White House, did not even give him a phone call. And so here he was at least acknowledged by Hitler. You know, a man that, area that says white, that wanted to promote white supremacy. And this man at least acknowledged. But when he came back home, and so I just, you know, I've always kind of felt that way about you, because I felt that, you know, you had to do so much work for yourself to just get the places. And, you know, I mean, you had some sponsors, but I thought that because you had these clouds over your head, and we're always seem to be targeted or framed different, like we're this angry black man or woman or something like that, and but you know, every time you got out there, you've never had any incidents. Just a good guy, yeah. Mild mannered, nice, and you know, I couldn't get you to swing and throw a punch at somebody. but you know, you're portrayed differently and stuff. So I see that. I mean, when you go to other places, you're received a lot different, like you said, in Holland and other places, they love their speed skating. But is it different for people, for the skin that they're in? You know, some people, we can go to other places, other countries, and we're treated, black people, as Africans, we're treated better than we are here in the United States. Have you found that throughout your travels?
Sometimes, but, you know, I don't know what they're saying, in their language. I've never had any trouble that experiences, but you know, I just feel that the media does a really bad job of portraying such as myself that are kind of making an impact and that they consider a threat, and they just want to kind of mark you up, make you negative, make you unmarketable, they want to marginalize you, and then, you know, let you sit, you know, on the sidelines instead of like promoting you and building you up. And that's something that I feel like I would like to discuss in further detail with my writing, because to me, there's no reason why I see the things that I see now with some of the black athletes, because there's two of them now that skated and they went to the Olympics, and one of them even got like the Sports Illustrated cover and before she got that, she was only, you know, she's won a few World Cup races. And
right.
back in my day, I was a world champion, a world record holder, and Sports Illustrated would have never dreamed of putting me on the cover. Not that I wanted
wow.
to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated. It's
right.
just that there's a principle, and that I'm, you know, I don't think that the things that Jesse Owens went through and the things that Robert Taylor went through or Jackie Robinson went through way back when, people, like, I shouldn't have to go through that in the year of, like, the 2000s. It's crazy to think, but unfortunately, that's just how it is, and I had to endure it, and I had to just kind of make a way for myself. But I'm not bitter about it. I'm just...
Right.
It's just the way it is.
But you notice the difference.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, go ahead.
It hurts my feelings to think that if I would have been skating now with my skills, how much further along I would have been able to make it for myself if I was good now compared to good then.
Hmm.
Wow, I tell you, it is just so different. And like you said, how we are just so marginalized in regards to as a person and just so many things that we do in our accomplishments and stuff like that. And I mean, you were just so well received by people. And I mean, when I've met you and other people, I knew that you were just in that circle and stuff, and everybody was just happy to be around you. I mean, but the media people, because, you know, I think that they lock into a certain narrative and they don't want to change that because that's what they want to do and stuff. And this is and I've talked to some media people and they've said they didn't like doing certain things because they were told that this is the angle, this is the approach we want you to have on this person, this is the question. You know, they do these things a certain way, but like I said, I've not seen you in a negative way where, you know, you respond to something where it gives them some ammunition. You know, it's just something that they create. So what are you doing now? You said you're coaching, or
yeah,
and are you coaching for the U.S. or what? What's going on?
No,
did the U.S.
So
give you any offers?
Of course not. Of course they didn't give me any offers. I work on my own. I have my own thing.
Okay.
I kind of just do it my own time, and I have people that come to me. I'm trying to grow and build that out, but other than that, I write and also try to, like, improve on my fitness and strength. You know, since I'm getting older, I think it's important to build strength and dexterity so that as I age, I don't want to be weak. That's something I learned from you. You always told me about having strength and power. And now that I don't have to, you know, do all the speed skating stuff, I'm starting to, like, convert myself into doing, like, strength, like upper body stuff. I'm getting the hang of it. I really enjoy it. I like it. And that's what kind of keeps me motivated and going.
Yeah. I tell you, that's all right. You know, I have my wife, we just started working out. I'd get up at 5, do my little thing, and then she'd get up at 5:30 and we'd go downstairs and work out. But it's a way of life. And, I mean, you know that from, you know, my brother, what he does, and Evander. I mean, Kimmy, we all trained, and I think, you know, it was a blessing getting to see you train and watch you do the things that you did and stuff like that, because it motivated us. You elevated us in our workouts and stuff just to be around Olympic athletes and just to see that type of training and dedication and stuff like that. And so I'm just amazed that you were able to stay focused and do that. But as a coaching now, you know, you said, of course, they didn't ask you here, but I would think, wow, somebody in the U.S. was like, hey, man, we would like to have this guy. This guy's got world records, international records, Olympic records. Let's get this guy to teach us something. I mean, looking at you as a coach, is there some stereotype with that as well, you think? I mean, on the racially, you know, like, you know, you're a good athlete, but as far as coaching and giving instructions and stuff like that, do you feel that sometimes that plays into it sometimes? Or, I mean, what? What's the reason, you think?
I think it's just the history. We've always had kind of a bad blood type of relationship with the governing body of America, like the U.S. Skating. And there's a lot of people in there that were very unhappy with my success. And I feel that, you know, they don't let things become water under the bridge. But even if they did offer me something, I would be reluctant to take it because of the history. I don't feel like it would be the right thing to do.
Right.
There'll have to be a lot of change for me to want to even consider being a part of their organization.
Now, did you work with the team? Did you work with the Japan team, or for a little while, or some team, another team from another country?
Yeah, I had a Japanese team that I trained, and I also went to China for a year to coach over there as well. So I have some type of, you know, international coaching experience, and I'm working on building up my coaches. My coaching history now, you know, there's levels to it, so I'm working on getting up to level 3, and then that way I can be more international competitions if I'm ever needed. They won't be able to say that I can't do something because of, you know, whatever reason they want to choose. So I try to give people not so many reasons or things to use against me if I want to, you know, pursue something.
Right. Now, when you said levels of coaching, I mean, you know, for speed skaters, you know, with someone with, I understand where some people, they are very good athletes, but they're not good coaches. And that transition that you're making and stuff like that, being a good athlete, world class, and now being a world class coach, is that tough for you? Like you just said, there's levels that you got to go through.
It's challenging because I knew, like, what I could do. I had checks and balances. I knew the mental part of the game. I had a good control over that. And then I knew how to, like, physically push and endure certain types of training that are very difficult. And a lot of these athletes now, they're kind of soft. And they don't have that same tough mental toughness mentality of, like, just getting through the training and pushing themselves and really working hard. I feel like a lot of the athletes nowadays, they just want things to be handed to them. And maybe for me, looking back, maybe not having everything given to me and me having to work twice as hard and accomplish double to get, you know, what other people are getting, maybe that works more so in my favor. Maybe I should thank those people that made it so hard for me to get this stuff. Yeah, it's challenging because, you know, I have a thing. I know it works for me, but I don't quite know what works for the athletes that I train. And it's like I'm going to school. When I talk to them, I'm learning them, I'm studying them, and I'm trying to figure out what works best for all these individual athletes that I coach.
Uh-huh. Wow. Well, I mean, I tell you, that is really something that you are able to, you know, maintain your focus. And, I mean, you're still an athlete. I mean, like you said, you have to work out. You're not going to let yourself wilter away. You still got to look the part because you still have to set examples when you're coaching and teaching, you know, and so there's some things that you have to do. And so I want to kind of go into a little more of, you know, like what you're doing now, what you think about where the sport is heading. I mean, you already kind of mentioned some of that. I mean, you know, like where you were back then and today, you know, will probably be different for you, but, you know, so we have this Erin Jackson. Was she on? I haven't seen the Sports Illustrated, but she was on the cover of that.
She was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and she's on these big giant billboards, like in Chicago for Xfinity. It's just like, and I, great athlete. I think that just with like this gender equality thing, and then wanting
right.
to be like diverse, like she checks so many boxes. And it's not quite, it doesn't, like, match the level of accomplishments that she had before going into the Olympics. But
right.
she won a gold medal, so that's great. But I look at it mm-hmm. in terms of, like, how I was at that stage in my career. When I was, like, a world record holder, I was a world champion, and none of these Olympic sponsors wanted anything to do with me. Sports Illustrated didn't want to, like, put me on the cover. Xfinity didn't want to put me on a billboard. and Toyota didn't want to give me a commercial back in 06.
Wow.
But, you know, there's a different, it's a different time now than it was then, and I'm happy that it's, you know, changing for the better of the athletes
right.
that are pursuing speed skating, but looking back, it's just like, for me as well, but it just wasn't, so you just got to get over the things that you don't, I don't have control over that, so you just got to move on, and be, I'm thankful that I was able to accomplish what I accomplished, because nobody sport wins. The media wanted me to lose, the people that were running the sport from our country wanted me to lose, and my teammates wanted me to lose. The only people that wanted
wow.
me to win were like people that I grew up with, like people from my community, and then of course like your brother and, you know, your family and stuff, but I had to
yeah.
go against so much. I'm just happy that I was
wow.
tough enough mentally to kind of endure it.
Yeah.
You know, back then there wasn't a such thing as mental health. No one, that's a new
yeah.
thing now. Now it's like mental health, you know, care about the athletes, but I can tell
right.
you, and I can even show you where I was getting like, and, you know, a lot of prejudiced messages right before my race on my website. Like, who should have to look
mm-hmm.
at this stuff and, you know, read in a newspaper all these negative things right before your Olympic race?
You know, I used to tease, but I wasn't teasing per se, but I was like, hey, I'm your body guy. Anytime you go somewhere here or there and stuff like that. But I'm sure at times I was jokingly saying it, but not jokingly in the sense that, no, I'm going where you go. I got you. But you were receiving threats and things of that nature, and I just didn't realize that.
Yeah, you know, it was a real thing. It was a real thing.
Yeah. I tell you, well, let's talk a little more about that, and then, you know, like I said, what you're going to be doing. You said you're doing a book, you know, with the coaching, and what does it look like, are you being compensated for your time at the level that you are, things of that nature? And then I have Evander, Kimmy, and my wife here. Of course, they're going to be wanting to just say hello to you. So we're going to be take a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. And so about 3 minutes or so, we'll be back. Get to it.
Last night I had a dream. When I got to Africa, I had one hell of a rumble. I had to beat Tarzan's behind first for claiming to be the king in the jungle. For this fight, I've wrestled with alligators. I've tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning and put thunder in jail. You know I'm bad. I have murdered a rock. I injured a stone and I hospitalized a brick. I'm so bad I make medicine sick. I'm so fast, man, I can run through a hurricane and don't get wet. When Joy Fuller meets me, he'll pay his debt. I can drown a drink of water and kill a dead tree. Wait till you see Muhammad Ali.
The face of truth is open. The eyes of truth are bright. The lips of truth are ever closed. And the head of truth is upright. The breath of truth stands forward. The gaze of truth is straight. Truth has neither fear nor doubt. Truth has patience to wait. The words of truth are touching. The voice of truth is deep. The law of truth is simple. All you sow, you reap. The soul of truth is flaming, the heart of truth is warm, the mind of truth is clear and firm through rain and storm. Facts are only its shadow. Truth stands above all sin. Great be the battle of life. Truth in the end shall win. Life of truth is eternal. Immortal is its past. Power of truth shall endure. Truth shall hold to the last.
This is the legend of Muhammad Ali, the prettiest fighter there ever will be. He talks a great deal, he brags indeed, of a powerful punch and blinding speed. The fistic world was dull and wearied. With a champ like Foreman, things had to be dreary. Now someone with color, someone with dash, he brings fight fans a running with cash. This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny. Ali fights great. He's got speed and endurance. If you sign to fight him, increase your insurance. Ali's got a left. Ali's got a right. If he hits you once, you're asleep for the night. And as you lie on the floor while the ref counts 10, you better hope and pray you don't meet me again. For I'm the man this poem is about, the true champion of the world, there isn't a doubt. Once I predicted and I knew the score, I told them I'd be champ of the world in 64. When I say three, they go in the third. Don't bet against me, I'm a man of my word. Do you remember when I predicted Sonny Liston's dismemberment? I hit him so hard, he forgot where October and November went. If I tell you a mosquito could pull a plow, don't ask how, hitch him up. I'd like for them to say he took a few cups of love. He took one tablespoon of patience, one teaspoon of generosity, one pint of kindness. He took one quart of laughter, one pinch of concern, and then he mixed willingness with happiness. He added lots of faith, and he stirred it up well. Then he spread it over a span of a lifetime, and he served it to each and every deserving person.
All right, we are back, Warriors Way Radio, with our Olympic champion, world champion, international champion, our first African-American, African, like speed skating champion, Johnny Davis, a great friend of the family, just a superhuman being. We're just so blessed for him to gave him a call, and he said, hey, sure, I would be glad to be on this show, and, you know, I guess one of the things I wanted to just kind of bring up, you know, is how he ended up coming here. You know, I read a little bit about, you know, his mother, and he said he had a friend that was skating, and he got into the ice skating from a friend, and you know, he just gravitated to that. He just kind of stayed with that. But just on his journey, we met him and how much he's grown and how much he has encouraged us. I have a young son, Evander. He's 24, and you know, he got to watch how Johnny trained, and you know, and my daughter and my wife met him, and just an all around good guy. And so I'm going to allow my daughter, since she's sitting right next to me, to say hello.
Hey, Johnny.
Hi, Kimmy.
How's it going?
Yeah, good. How are you?
You know, I'm living the dream. Can't complain. Day by day, things get better, you know. It's really good hearing your voice. You sound well. Definitely proud of you, and, you know, thank you for, you know, basically being another brother. I got three brothers.
Oh. No thanks needed. I was always happy to come hang out, and just, you guys, like, just wanted to have me around. I always appreciated that, because, you know, I grew up the only child, so I always loved having, you know, people that looked at me that way. So thank you.
Oh, you're my favorite pizza pal. So I'll go ahead and pass you off to Sabrina.
Okay.
Hey, Johnny, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. I have a question for you. I know that family is really big in your life. Are you planning on at all or even thinking about starting your own family?
You know, being, like, I've been part of the Olympic thing since, for the past 20 years. This is, like, the first time in 20 years I wasn't a part of the Olympics, and it's hard to wrap my head around it because it's something that I've, you know, trained all my, you know, pretty much all my life to do. I think someday when I have more of a path on what I'm doing after skating and I'm happy and content with kind of the direction my life is going, then I like to, like, look into that. But until then, I'm going to keep moving. Stay focused.
That's good. Well, I'm proud of you as well. I have not known you as long as my husband and my bonus kids, but I'm really proud of you. I remember when, this was 2 years ago, I went to Washington, D.C. for an event, and I went to the National Black African American Museum there. And I remember seeing you there, seeing not you in person, but a poster or a statue there of you.
Yeah.
And your accomplishments. And I thought, oh my gosh, I know him. And I was so proud. I was so proud to see you there.
Were you aware of that? Yeah.
Were you aware
that
you had that there?
My family went to go see the statue. I haven't been able to, you know, with COVID and things like that, but someday I'm going to get out there and check it out. I heard it's really cool. I've seen it.
It is.
Can't
really
believe
nice.
That I have a statue. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to pass it on to Evander, and it was nice talking with you.
Nice talking to you, too.
Hey, how's it going, Shawnee?
Good, Evander. How are you, man? I listened to all your stuff, man. You're going to graduate school now, I heard. That's what's up, man.
Yeah, I'm currently in grad school, you know, in New Mexico. I'm doing everything online. Everything's virtual. So, you know, I'm just in the meantime, focusing more so on my training.
Right on.
It's tough, though, right now, like kind of like how you were saying, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, facilities, especially in the wintertime, you know, where I can go to and just kind of perfect my craft and be on the field, you know, so especially with all the snow outside. So, you know, that kind of sucks, but I'm making the most of my opportunities, and I know what I have to focus on. So when it comes down to, you know, combine things, so, you know, it is what it is, but, you know,
right.
I think that's going to help me. My circumstances. So, but I did have a question, or actually, have you used like your social media platform to kind of like tell your story at all, or really kind of, you know, make yourself, you know, more relevant just in case people really forgot, you know, the accomplishments that you have made in life? With your whole Olympic journey and all of that, because nowadays I feel like if you don't brand yourself as much on social media, it's easy for people to kind of like look past the accomplishments that you have. So have you really tapped into that?
Yeah, you know, I hear that all the time. Like, I get these like appearances for, you know, sponsors. I had one for Delta, and I had one for iFit, which is like equipment, like training equipment. And they're like, yeah, you know, you really need a social media, social awareness, like social media platform awareness. I'm thinking, I do, like, and I hear you, but, you know, I'm kind of old school, man. Like, I was, like, in my prime, like, none of this was around, you know, like, to the extent it is now. There was no Instagram, you know, there's, like, Facebook and whatever, but I always kind of stayed away from it. But I think, more or less, man, when I'm closer to, like, completing my book, and, like, having, like, a real plan of, like, what I'm wanting to do, and I want to, like, share more with, like, what I'm up to, like, what I'm doing and working towards, then I think I'll probably activate the social media and start building it up. But I really, like, right now, I like just having my privacy, being a private citizen and not having people, like, worrying, like, wondering about me. Like, it's so hard to, like, stay relevant as is. You're going against people that are, you know, that can post a lot of interesting things about their life. But
exactly.
You know, I'm more of a private guy, but eventually, like, you know, they push you towards social media. So yeah, I'll be going that route someday, man. But I have to be closer to like knowing and finishing like my projects, like the book and things like that. Yeah.
Most definitely. Yeah, my friend had a, you know, pretty good. One of my really good friends had a really good talk with me. You know, he's branded himself very well, and I'm kind of the same way where I'm pretty private. I kind of like to do my own thing and, you know, kind of stay down until I come up. But he really put a thought in my head to where, you know, a lot of people want to see the process. You know, a lot of people don't just want to see when you make it. A lot of people want to see, like, you know, the hard times, the good times, and you know, all the kind of, all the obstacles you've, you know, done to get to where you were. So that's why I kind of asked you about that, just because, you know, that's something I'm trying to focus on, you know, branding myself and putting myself out there, especially since, you know, times are different now, especially my generation. You know, everything is social media. That's the big question I have for you. Anna, diet. What was your regimen, you know, when you were hardcore training? Do you have, like, a routine on, you know, how you ate and how many meals did you have per day, snack, or did you sneak a little junk food in there, or were you just really disciplined, or you just, had a, you know, strict diet?
I was always under the impression, like, as long as I'm willing to, like, do the work, like, the diet didn't really matter, you know, especially when I was younger.
Yeah.
But as I got older, I had to have more of, like, a regimen where I couldn't, like, overindulge in certain things. I would give myself one day a week where I would, like, eat something that I really enjoyed. But the rest of it was, like, making sure I had the right amount of proteins and drinking the right amount of fluids, you know, and recovery and things like that. Because as you get older, you know, that stuff doesn't, like, replenish itself the way it used to when you're younger. So, it got stricter as I got older and more, like, into, like, I didn't know about it. I wasn't educated, you know. It's just like work hard. I didn't know about fueling the body. And it's like, you know, the better mm-hmm. you fuel it, the more you can push yourself, the harder you can train, and, the better you can recover. I was never aware of that when, you know, I was younger. But as I got older, yeah, learned it the hard way.
And I guess my last question is going to be, have you had any injuries that, you know, where you really had to, you know, lock in and find a different place to really focus on recovery, you know, how you went about that?
Oh, yeah, I had a few bad, like, groin tears, and, you know, part of skating,
right,
you need your adductors and adductors, and if you don't have that strong enough, because you kind of focus on certain muscle groups, but you don't focus on, like, every part of, like, the hip, you know, the smaller muscles that kind of you don't really focus on as much. You just got to do your due diligence, man. You have to train everything thoroughly, and then you have to, you know, give it support. Like, you need to have lower core abdominal muscles. You have to work on your glutes, your hamstrings, and things like that. And I went through therapy, and I learned all those tricks. And once I was educated and I knew what I needed to do, then I just added it to my regimen so that, you know, I didn't have those groin tears and things like that. Because that can be very, that can be career-ending. So, luckily for me, it always happened towards the end of the season. I had time to, like, you know, rest and recover, time off where I could focus and build my body back up so that once training started, I was 100%, so I can give myself at every training 100%.
Perfect. Well, it was nice talking to you. Nice to be able to ask you a few questions. And I'm going to give you back to my dad.
Cool, man. Good hearing from you, man. Best of luck to you.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, I'm thinking, you know, when you do get ready to, you know, maybe do a book release or you want to discuss it on the show, that would be awesome that we could, you know, set that up one day as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. But the closer I get to it, for sure, we'll have to touch base again, promote the book.
Right. Yeah. So, are you, I know it's tough to been training that way your whole life, and, you know, the Olympics, you know, like Sabrina asked you about relationships, but that Olympic training and everything that you've been doing, that's your relationship, that's your life, and that's what you're doing now. Is there something else, though, you know, you thinking about on the side or anything like that? I mean, you know, people always kind of, you know, like you said, you write the book. I also think somebody would like to kind of want to put a movie out there on you. Has anybody even talked to you about things like that?
I'm talking to a guy now. He did a documentary on the uprising in Ferguson. And I'm talking to him now about some stuff, and he has an idea, but I don't really get my hopes up until, you know,
right,
I see it and it's nice, but I think he recommended for me to, like, do the story first, like the book aspect
right.
of it, so that,
right.
you know, Hollywood can't, like, put their twist on it how they did, like, the Blind Side guy and the Blind Side movie. So I'm going to do my due diligence, but I definitely, you know, I'm trained to take advantage of the opportunities that present themselves. So if this does take fruition, I'll be ready for it.
Yeah, I think most definitely, and I think that, I mean, you've opened my eyes to just a lot of things, because today people don't want to believe that a lot of the things that went on 30, 40, 50, 100, 200 years ago still relevant today. I mean, when you think about, you know, Jesse Owens and everything he did, and, you know, but he couldn't sleep in the hotels. A lot of the hotels, when he did go to the hotels, he had to go to the back door. A lot of the restaurants, you know, they could eat, but they would give him the food outside. They couldn't go inside the restaurant. They would let him order it, but they would have to take it outside. And then they wouldn't wash the plates because, you know, they were no good, so they would always break the plates. So they started breaking the plates and stuff. I mean, it was just such an ugly type of situation that went on and on and on, and just the ugliness and the hatred for the skin that we're in, I mean, that just doesn't go away. And there's always something that to remind us of this. You know, I mean, we don't never seem to be able to have that sanctuary among so-called friends and stuff, because it's going to be different for them, because a lot of the friends, you know, especially in this sport, and that, you know, you're in speed skating, you're surrounded with pretty much nothing but white people. You know, unless, you know, like you said, you were with some of your people when you were in these other places, but when we got to this other level, not that we can't get there, but I mean, so are you doing something now to try to maybe motivate people to get into the sport?
I feel that with the success and how the media portrays the athletes, it has a lot to do with people wanting to come over to the sport. So I think once I set my platform the right way and I have, like, you know, some type of, like, support with, like, the media and, like, things like that, then it's easier to persuade people to want to do the sport. But right off the top, I wouldn't want to promote the sport because I wouldn't want people to go through the things that I went through.
Right.
Took a toll on my family, my friends, everyone that, you know, cared for me. I feel like it changed me as a person in some aspects, but
yeah.
It's not something that I would recommend off the top. There's other things that are more, to me, more beneficial and better for athletes like us to do, and actually gives you things that you, like, you can get scholarships, you can go on to be a professional, you don't get stuck in an amateur sport. So I don't know, I'm kind of on the fence with that one, but, you know, I will always love the sport of skating. I just wouldn't off the top recommend
yeah.
it to people.
Yeah. Now, what was the young lady that, she was a gymnast, that she didn't do all the different, she didn't compete in all of the, Simone Biles. She didn't compete in all of the, she had some type of dizzy spill or whatever, but it's something common that
she
get in gymnastics.
She had
and, so she didn't.
The twist, she called. She had
right.
the case of the twist.
And so she Twisty, didn't want to, right. And so she decided not to compete, and then how they talked about her. And And when you talk about the mental health issue, I mean, you know, they didn't appear to lighten up on her. They just talked about, you know, what a quitter she was, and, you know, this is the Olympics and stuff. Now, her teammates, they had a different attitude, but, you know, you heard a lot of people, not, you know, on the radio, but on the other media people and stuff, and then later on they changed their tune when they started talking about certain things, because I think there was a Russian girl that had went through the same thing, and she kept competing, and she ended up becoming paralyzed. And then later on, I think she died, but she was an Olympic athlete. And so it's something that they are aware of, they know of, but this sense of competition, the mental stress, and then for everything else that was going on with the sexual assaults that these girls went through. I mean, it's just something. I mean, there's always something dark and lurking in sports, business, whatever. I mean, this is all business. I mean, because, you know, they market you some kind of way. They manipulate the athlete to get them to do this and that, and however it may suit them. And have you run into some people specifically that you just knew you had to get away from? But at the time, you really didn't have a choice because, I mean, this was something you were involved in and this was the go-to person.
Yeah, like a lot of the people, like the staff that I had bad relationship with, you know, they get picked on to come to the Olympics or to go to World Championships. And as much as I don't want to work with them and I do my best to avoid them, sometimes you just gotta do what you can. And unfortunately, I wasn't in a position to, you know, do it any differently. But, yeah, I feel like that's just in almost every sport.
Mm. Wow, I tell you, that is, I mean, there's some thick skin, I mean, you got to have that to deal with it. And it's a lot of psychological trauma and like I said, they're so into the trauma and things that people are going through. And, you know, it hurts me just to think about all the ugliness that's going on. And, you know, and I think about, was it Miss America that killed herself? I mean, we get Miss USA, we get Miss Universe, and we get, I think it was three or four black women with these titles, and, you know, we're saying, what a great year, and then one of them decides, you know, and we don't know what all she was going through, but we also understand that there's always some type of pressure, and I think about so many different things with the suicide that's going on, and like I said, people don't want to acknowledge that, you know, a lot of it is from a lot of the systematic racism that people want to acknowledge. They act like that it's not existing. But it rears its ugly head every day for us. I mean, we see it in things and just how people look at us sometimes, or how they don't look at us. You know, I mean, they treat us a certain way, we know it. But we've been always been able to wear that mask. And so I guess I'm saying to you, asking you, you know, doing a lot of the things that you did, winning, losing, and just having to wear a mask around these people because you didn't want them to know how you really, really felt. Or at times, did you really have to let somebody know how you felt? Did you have moments like that?
I just learned that no one really cares, like, especially those people that, like, you're competing against and the people that are your so-called friends or your, what is the word I'm looking for, acquaintances. They don't care. Uh-huh. And that's for, like, people like you, your brother, my mom, my close friends, and people that I consider family. We can talk behind the scenes about that stuff, but nobody really cares about the if ands, and whys.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta keep that stuff to yourself because the moment you you know, try to like let someone know about a injustice, you know, then they say that you claim the race card, or you know, they'll try to contort it and use it against you and make you look bad when they're the one that's doing the wrong. So I learned to just keep it to myself, and you know, the thing that's good about it is the history. It doesn't lie. Like, everything's on record.
Right.
Anybody that wants to read about any of the injustices that I've been through or the prejudices that I faced, it's all on the media. It's all out there on the internet. They can't take that away.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's there.
Well, I know, like I said, there had to be a lot of pressure on your mom. How's your mother doing?
My mom's doing well. She's doing really well. She's happy.
Yeah,
that's more than I can ever ask. I just always wanted her to be happy. Yeah. She's the one that made it possible for me to, you know, reach this level. But And I wish that she got the roses that she deserved, you know, but I make sure to every day to let her know how much I appreciate her. And I thank her for all the things that she's done for me, because without her, there's no way that I would have been able to do the things I was needed to do in order to reach this level.
Right, right. Most definitely. I mean, you know, it's, I think about that, and, you know, just taking these trips and then, you know, meeting my brother and then taking the chance and saying, okay, because, you know, see, they're strange people out here. You know, they act, they act nice, they look nice, but they do strange things. And, but we guys took a chance, and, I mean, the energy was right. I mean, we do what we do. I mean, we knew the love and the sincerity and everything. But again, you know, there's people that sometimes look like us that don't know who we really are because we've been lied to so much. And, you know, and they don't think with an African mind, you know, they think of what they know. And, you know, this European mindset, you know, money over people all day long, you know. And, but, you know, you... I think you've been just such a role model for so many people that you don't know, because I know that when you worked out different times, you know, at the house, and people would see you and they would ask me and stuff, and they would, "Is that Johnny?" And I was like, "Yeah." And then he still loves skaters. I was like, "Yeah." And what's he doing? I said, "Yeah, he's a good friend. He trains with yeah." But, you know, just, I mean, they just seeing you and stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, they know who you are, you know, and it's just, it would be nice, you know, that, like you said, you get your due. Because when you think about a lot of things, I think Jesse Owens, he got the medal of, I can't think of what the specific medal was, but it was 04. They gave it to him 15 years later, but he certainly wasn't going to get his proposal bill. But you know, it is just something. And but he had passed away, I think, prior to that, because you know it's sad. A lot of the things that we go through. Now Jesse Owens, when he was a young kid, he had developed a tumor in his chest, and they weren't treating black people at the local hospital. So he couldn't go to the local hospital. So his mom and dad put him on the kitchen table, and they cut the tumor out of his, they sterilized some a scissor and a knife, and they cut the tumor out of his chest. And so he died at 66, and they said that he had some type of lung cancer, and you know, could it have been caused by, you know, the scarring and everything that was done when they took that lump that they took out of his chest? We don't know. But the thing is, you know, he had competed after that. He had went through just so much. But like I said, life is so different for the black and brown people on this planet, and a lot of people don't know it. And I certainly didn't know a lot of the things that you went through, and that is just so troubling to hear. But again, people don't want to believe that type of thing happens today. Even although this Aaron Jackson has received these accolades and haven't done this and that, I guarantee that he's going through something. You know, I don't think that they make it easy on anybody, and when they do, they want something in return because it's benefiting them some kind of way. And like you said earlier when you said this thing about, you know, they say, I mean, what is a race card? I don't understand what that is. You know, you guys created this situation, and then when we complain about it, you say that we're pulling this card. You've already demonstrated the hate, you know, for us, bringing us here, changing our name, our religion, separating us from families and killing and murdering and raping us. And, I mean, you've demonstrated what type of people you are. And then when you look at what's going on today, I look at a lot of the killings, you know, in from your hometown, Chicago. I mean, that's, I mean, I'm sure that's got to be just troubling just thinking about that. I mean, any thoughts about that? You know, I mean, trying to even reach, I mean, I know you do coaching and stuff like that, but we always kind of talk about, you know, how are people living, you know, and why is it so dangerous? Why, you know, I mean, your thoughts, what do you think?
Chicago is this, my mom doesn't even want me to go back. You know, I haven't been back to Chicago in like probably like at least 3 years. I've been in Salt Lake City. That's where I coach. And
right.
My mom prefers me to stay out here because she's fearful of, like, this, you know, sense of this violence and the robberies and all that other stuff in Chicago. So, you know, I just feel like people need to have some type of outlet. I feel like people need something to do in the areas that the crime is the highest in the city. Well, it's starting to spread now, too. You can see things are happening in the Gold Coast, and there's smash and grabs everywhere downtown. And it's really sad to think about it, but there's just not enough outlets for people to do things, to have something to look forward to. And then they just get caught up, and the rest is history from there. But it's sad. I wish that the mayor and the people would do something more about it. I'm pretty sure that they try it, but maybe there's this a disconnect with how they go about doing it and really changing the area. Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad. Yeah, it's sad when you think that you want to go back to your home and you know, and have that hero's welcome and support. You know, people know who you are, but, you know, there's an ugliness that's rearing in the hearts and minds of so many people. I don't care where you go, and this is what they do. Yeah, it works in some places, but man, I just, you know, man, it's tough thinking like that. I mean, like for me, I mean, I live just on the outskirts of Milwaukee, but I can't see myself leaving Milwaukee. But as bad as it is, I just can't see myself leaving it, because I'm trained to help and trying to help people navigate through all this madness and do the right things. And we had a young lady that was killed at this tavern. I don't know if you heard about it. What's it called? Sabrina Brownsville? Brownstone? And basically it was they wanted to change the age requirement in regards to the people that they let in the bars or let in the club. And so they wanted to make it like 30-something because, you know, on the average, you got 14-year-olds to 20, early 20s, and just a little up, just under 30 years old that are committing most of these crimes. And so they basically, two girls and a guy, told the guy that, hey, we're doing an age requirement thing. And, you know, he didn't fit that age requirement. Long and short of it, he got upset and started shooting and ended up killing one of the girls and injuring two other people. He shot two other people. But, I mean, and that was the reason, basically. I talked to someone else about it, and they said that the guy had some other issues going on. But, you know, bottom line is I just can't see taking someone's life. I mean, I'm protecting myself. I'll do what I have to do under the circumstances. And I've done those things, and I've had to do that on the job one time, and it was a clear-cut situation. A guy came at me with a scalpel, tried to slash my throat. I fired one time, and I stopped him. I've had other situations, guys with knives, this, that, even guns, and I was fortunate enough just for my training to take them down and do what I need to do, and I survived those situations. But it's getting pretty ugly here, you know. I'm in agreement with your mom. I'd like you to stay out there in Salt Lake City. I mean, you're pretty comfortable there.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's you're so easy here. Everything's just, I feel safe. I don't have to look over my shoulder. You know,
right.
Simple life. It's clean. It's environmentally friendly. it might not be as exciting as Chicago, or the food might not be as good, but, you know, I can always visit Chicago. But she doesn't even want me to visit. She's like, stay there. I'll come to you.
Right. But she's comfortable there.
She just loves Chicago. She thinks that for her, she's, you know, it's not the same for an older lady than it is for a younger member of black male. We're targeted by our own, and we're targeted by the police, and that's
right.
A lot
exactly.
of things working against you there.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a lot of things that people don't want to hear, and that's one of the things that I just kind of bring to the front, you know, on this broadcast, because, you know, we just got so many people that won't share the truth about things, and me being a former law enforcement person and the things that I went through just because of the skin that I'm in, you know, my white counterparts, they don't have those issues. And then they look at me, and that's one of the things that's always said, you know, you're pulling the race card. And, you know, and I'm sure some of the things that, you know, they've said that to you in speed skating. I'm sure they said stuff like that to you, like you're a credit to your race, you're different from the other guys, and all these micro infractions and stuff. I mean, that adds up. I mean, this sport, I mean, the competition. I mean, you had to be one of the most mentally toughest people on the planet to deal with everything that you were dealing with and then win. I mean,
that's
you know,
what she said that it's a miracle that I even won. Nobody wanted me to win.
Yeah. I mean, how do you even compete that way? You know, you got teammates that don't want you to win. You know, they're rooting for love. They're rooting for the other country. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Here you are, born, raised here, and this is what you're dealing with. And, you know, and like I said, your story needs to be told, because, you know, so much of this. And because we need to, you know, we need to let these people know that we got the monsters here that are in charge of our kids. And at some point, when these young men and women that are competing for this country that doesn't love us, and when they get an opportunity to exploit us in some way, shape, or form in the worst possible way, they don't hesitate, you know, or just leave you where, you know, you no longer become relevant to them anyway. But you
That's
know,
right.
you remain relevant to us. We love you. We appreciate you. And I'm learning so much about you just all this. It turns my stomach. I like to go there and just start whooping a whole bunch of people. I know my brother doesn't have that mentality. But I don't, man, I just like to punch people. I'm holding violence. You know, when you do these ugly and hurtful things to people, and, like, because I've been around you where your focus is just trying to get getting the most out of yourself so that you can perform and do the things that you need to do. And that just had to be just so difficult under those circumstances to perform at that high level. I mean, your mother, I mean, oh, my goodness, she is so on point. That is just amazing that you even play, you know, not let alone win. Man, and then to win and get these threats and just people just not acknowledging you the way you think they should, you know. And I think I recall something that happened really awkward when I think we were at my brother's house when you guys used to stay there on Wright Street.
Yeah.
And I think there was something going on where everybody was watching. I think we were watching you on TV. And it was a bunch of us upstairs watching on the TV and stuff like that. But it was some kind of conference or something, a discussion that went through or something like that. But it was, and we were wondering, are they going to ask Kasani? Are they going to talk to him? And I don't think that they did. You know, they talked about other people, but they didn't mention him. I just can't remember what that was specifically. I got to be. I wish he would have been free. Right now, he told me he's coaching with a pro team out there. I think he's in Green Bay.
Okay.
He's doing something, so he wasn't able to get through and, you know, call in tonight because he said he works until 8 o'clock. But I really wanted him to, you know, tap in and just have some comments. But, you know, like I said, he talked about you and did you know much about Paul as far as some of the things that he did?
Paul?
Yeah.
Your nephew? Your nephew Paul?
Yeah. You know, my nephew, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I remember
talked,
Paul skating.
Yeah. Oh, did you ever see him skate?
I seen him skate a few times, yeah. I did.
Yeah, because I know with him, he won some competition, and Governor Dreyfus gave him some type of written letter of accomplishment. And or Dreyfus, I think that's the name it was. And well, when he was in the picture, and I was trying to find that. I know my mother has it, but it showed him wearing those tights. And people were making comments when he got in school that week, and he gave up on it. I mean,
yeah.
I know you said there was nothing that was going to deter you from it. I mean, what really motivated you to just keep at it? With all of this going on, all this hate, all this, you know, people not being for you and just all of this, and you just kept at it. You know, I know it still had to be tougher, even when you have family and friends. You know, you still like for people that were competing with you to, and especially if they're on your team, to be in support of you.
I guess for me, it just the amount that I've seen people do for me, like in terms of like Olu, your brother, opening up his house for me and giving me a place to stay every time I was in Milwaukee. My mom, how hard she worked. All the negative was outweighed by just the amount of what the people believed in me. I just felt like I couldn't let them down. Like I love that they believed in me, because there's a lot of people who didn't. That discouraged me, but what really fueled me and kept me going was just the love that I was receiving from people that believed in me, and I just wanted to show them, like, hey, thanks for believing in me and taking a chance, because so many people didn't. I just wanted to give back. I had to make sure that they knew that I was doing everything I could in my power to get to that level, and once I got there, I felt so fulfilled because I didn't let those guys down.
Well, you know, I'm so glad you're saying the things that you said, because, you know, I know it's motivating to me, but even more so Evander, because, you know, you guys are speaking that language that, you know, you're still wanting to do the things that you've been doing your whole life that you love, and that, you know, there's no doubt that you wanted the best ever in that speed skating. And, you know, just the difficulties that you're going through, and even that you're not competing anymore, it's still a struggle, you know, because of how they frame you. And so I'm so looking forward to the book. Have you thought about a title yet?
It's a work in progress. I did the writing more for like therapy. It was like therapeutic for me to just sit there and be uninterrupted while I could just like write my thoughts and feelings and just get everything on paper. And it helped me come with like, you know, helped me find some type of clarity and closure of like kind of moving forward, not being bitter or upset or angry that things could have went a different way for me in my career.
Right.
The title's a work in progress. I have a few ideas, but I just got to finish it, and then when I get to that point, I'm just going to start promoting it, and either it's going to get picked up or I'm going to self-publish it. But either way, it's going to get done, something that I vow to myself that I'm going to do.
Yeah. Well, I know I most definitely will, you know, want to read that, just have a discussion on that. I mean, it's just, man, I hurt so inside just hearing it. It pisses me off because I know a lot of these people, some of them probably were sitting at the table when we had you guys over for Christmas dinner, you know? It's just sad, though, that we embrace these people. I mean, because we don't have these same ill feelings towards them, despite what they do with us and to us. I mean, we just don't harbor that kind of hate. You know, I guess the sad thing is for those of us that don't know ourselves, do have that hate, but we hate more on each other and take it out on each other. And that's what we're seeing a lot of, you know, like I said, a lot of unlike-minded people not thinking with an African mind, you know. And so all of this destruction and hate and, you know, moving forward and stuff because, you know, they're so contaminated with, you know, just the ugliness of this society. And it's not getting better, and people don't want to address certain things. And, you know, like I said, they like to frame things a certain way. I mean, you've just been just a remarkable person, along with one of the greatest athletes of all time. No doubt, question about that. You've just done so many things. I mean, I used to watch you skate around the track and stuff like that, and I turned my head one way, and by the time I turned back around, you had done a lap. And I'm like, holy cow, and you were just coasting and just moving like that. And I just couldn't, and I would hear people how they were commenting. And even the commentations were kind of racist because they would talk about how fast and smooth you were. And just your speed was just so, I mean, the athleticism. But I'm like, this is a skilled sport. You got to stay on ice, and you got to move like that. Your skill has to be at a level that's just off the charts. And, you know, you don't hear a lot of that when they talk about that. And so, like I said, your endurance for everything that you've done and endured in this sport and paved the way for so many people like this Aaron Jackson, because there's some things that she needs to read your book. I hope you get it out in time for her to, you know, hear this. Have you had contact with her or...
We spoke a few times. It's just that, well, you know, she's also out here in Salt Lake City, but the thing that I don't do is I don't impose my will on nobody.
Right.
You know, if she needs anything from me, you know, I'm there. I'm always going to be an open, I'll be an asset any way that someone feels that they need. You know, I've had my time. This is her time now. And I hate when people try to do that with me, that try to cling on and try to claim success in areas where they didn't really, like, devote themselves in. You know, it's all after the fact.
Right.
And I would hate to do that, so I stay clear of that. But, you know, like, friendly conversation, you know, advice here and there, you know, what I see. Mm-hmm. But it has to be where it's not unsolicited. I don't want to give unsolicited advice.
Right. Well, I just mean it just as well as just kind of being a big brother to her in the sense that she knows that you're somebody that she can go to that would kind of get some of the things if she opens up and feels that she needs to talk to somebody at some point.
You know, that's a given. That's the least I can do for anyone in the sport. Anyone that feels that they need someone to, like, talk to in terms of advice or wanting someone that has the expertise, experience, I'll always be there for anybody that needs that. Never turn people away.
I tell you, this has been just such a wonderful conversation. Any closing thoughts in regards to we know about your book, the coaching, you know, it's different levels. And I guess a question in regards to the coaching. Are you compensated pretty good? I mean, do you have even sponsors
that even support you with the coaching and stuff. Is there a facility named after you somewhere or in the makings? I'm just wondering.
You know, those are things that that would have happened if I was more, I think, in the positive light of the media. They kind of really kind of destroyed my, like, reputation. And I feel like if they would have shown me in the light that I should have been shown in, we would have these things now, but they just didn't want that, I guess. So I'm stuck with what I'm stuck with. But I have enough to get by. I help people any way that I can, the same way your brother does. We do it more for the love, and there's compensation there because, you know, I have bills and stuff to pay, but it's not where it would be if I was, say, Olympic champion, world champion from any other country in the world. It would be a different story. It's just that in America, the sport is so small, and people just don't really care about it the same way that, you know, people that devote their lives to it would.
Mm. Wow. Well, look, we thank you for joining us tonight. Sabrina, you want to say goodbye? Amanda?
Hi, Tony. Nice listening.
Bye.
Nice talking to you. It was nice hearing your insight, you know, on everything you went through and all the challenges you faced. And, you know, I'm really going to, you know, take those with me and, you know, carry that advice into my future endeavors with my athletic future. So appreciate you.
Hey, man.
Yeah,
Thank you.
This was really awesome. So, so we're going to, like I said, we'll revisit this, have this conversation again. I wish you nothing but luck and anything I can do for you. And I have a lot of free time, so if you ever need an escort somewhere here or there, I don't care where, I got you.
I know you do, man. I look forward to someday where I can go under your wing and you can train me.
I
can't wait for that.
I guess. Yeah, most definitely. And you let that little Erin know she comes to Milwaukee, she's got a big brother here that has her back, without a doubt.
Sure,
and if she wants
some
food, too. You know, for the holidays, we cook, we do all that stuff, you know. Them other boys didn't know what collard greens and all that stuff was, but we showed them.
I'll pass along the note. I'll tell her for sure.
All right, now. All right, you take care. I love you, and thanks again for being with us tonight.
Love you too. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate that. Thank you
okay.
so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye bye.
All right, you were listening to Warriors Way. We had a conversation with our Olympic and world champion, Johnny Davis. We will be back next Thursday on Warriors Way with another program we hope you're going to like. This is a call-in format. The number is 516-418-5674. I repeat, 516-418-5674. 7-4 Warriors Way, continuing the fight. We air Thursday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. So we thank you for, again, joining us tonight, and we're going to be closing out now.
When the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, when the war is won, we will be sure. We will be sure. Oh, glory.
Glory. Glory.
Oh,
glory. Glory.
Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon. Formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. justice is juxtapositioning us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is up. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh,
man, woman, and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. No one can win the war individually. It takes the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory, the coming of the Lord. My eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes,